Long-term trends, and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team and all things maritime.
And good morning, everybody, or afternoon or evening, wherever you are. We really appreciate your time to join us here for today's Mid-Rat. As you probably heard, all my notes just hit the floor, but that's the joys of doing a live podcast. And for those that are with us live, I would like to invite everybody, if you scroll to the bottom of the show page, that's where you will find a link to the chat room, and you can roll in there with the usual suspects. If you have some observations you would like to share with us during the course of the show, or if there's a question you would like for us to direct during the next hour, we'll be glad to pull that into the conversation as we move forward. And as always, if you haven't already, go ahead and subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes, Spreaker, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. That way, if you want to hear what we had to say earlier, or you just want to catch up on all the podcasts you might have missed before, that's the best way to do it. And hey, let's go ahead and roll in today's show. Y'all may have noticed something a little different at the beginning of the show, because that was actually our first intro that we updated since then. Yes, we've been at this 13 years, but we have only recorded two intros, and I wanted to put our first intro out there because we've got a returning guest today that was with us from the start, and actually we can assign either credit or blame to him for Mid-Rats being with us. But today we're going to have with us author, historian, teacher, and all-around good friend Claude Berube, and we're going to talk about the third novel in the Connor Stark series that just came out, titled The Philippine Pact, and you can find links to it on the show page. And in The Philippine Pact, we see the returning of some of your favorite characters from the first two books in the series, the Aiden Effect, Siren Song. He brings some new players onto the stage as well. And as always of Claude's novels, they may be fiction, but they bring stuff to the front, usually a little bit ahead of the news. So Claude, welcome back to Mid-Rats. It's glad to have you on board.
I'm glad to be back. Thanks so much for having me.
And I guess probably the easiest way to kick things off is tell the listeners a bit, what is The Philippine Pact about?
The Philippine Pact is about a potential conflict in the South China Sea and Chinese influence on the region with a specific target. What we find at the beginning of this novel is Connor Stark, the former naval officer turned mercenary or private security officer, if you will, has his company working with the Philippine government on the island of Balabac, which is the southernmost island in the Philippine Islands, very small island. And during this exercise, he finds that things are taking on a very real aspect, contrary to what they had planned for. And so we find Connor with the private security folks on the island. The two subplots to this, we'll find the characters that we've seen before. Damian Golzari is now a former diplomatic security service agent, and he is in Paris investigating a human trafficking organization. And mostly at Camp David, we find the new national security advisor, Ambassador C.J. Sumner, who we saw as one of the primary figures in the Aiden Effect, and we saw her briefly at the end of Siren Song. And she's advising the president on how to deal with this growing crisis in the Philippines as a government is about to be brought down, as a cyber attack is launched, and as more diplomatic difficulties emerge. Strangely enough, you know, you said that sometimes these things reflect reality. And what I didn't expect when I was writing this about a year and a half ago, when I selected Balabac Island and the Philippines. Just a couple of weeks ago, I saw in the news that there were U.S. military exercises with the Philippine government, and one of the four sites was Balabac Island. And to be frank, I really didn't know that there was any kind of military presence on Balabac. But it's always good to see some of these names in the news and to really tell the tale of what's going on in the high seas, particularly with China's growing role in the world and how Connor Stark's company tends to find itself in the middle of some of these small wars.
Yeah, you've in all three books, you've put the locations on major sea lines of communication, and mm-hmm. I assume that was intentional, and you've carefully selected Aden and Sri Lanka and the Philippines. Talk a little bit about that. When you're sitting down, you say, I've got this a series of books in mind. I assume you had this series mm-hmm. in mind to begin with. Do you lay out, these are important issues, this is why this area is important, and I'm going to base my books on that because everybody needs to know that these are potentially troubled waters?
Absolutely right, and I would go back to a few years ago when the Naval Cabin Museum held its first NavyCon, and over the years you guys have both been involved with those, and my intent for NavyCon was to expose Navy operations that the United States does every day, issues that we deal with every day, to a much broader audience, namely the science fiction community, who actually understands naval operations, but only in terms of the, you know, whether it's the Honor Harrington series by David Weber, the Star Trek or Star Wars series, Babylon 5, etc. I just wanted to take those Navy stories and educate and inform a broader public with NavyCon. The same is true for these books. Not a lot of them take place simply on land, and if they do, it's mostly islands or island nations. And I that's exactly what I do, Eagle One, is when I have an idea for a book, I'll take a look at a general region, and the criteria I use, number one, there's got to be a geographical interest for the United States so that we can inform people about why is this particular region important. So that's why the first one took place with the Gulf of Aden. And I wrote it, you know, as Somali piracy was really expanding, and it came out the year that it reached its height. And then the next thing I do is I look more broadly at the region. Okay, which countries do I really want to learn about? Which ones have a real impact on this? So that's why I chose Yemen in that case. And then obviously Sri Lanka, very important in terms of maritime operations because you had the Tamil Sea Tigers, the terrorist organization, and probably one of the best efforts to develop a maritime terrorist organization in the past 30 or 40 years. And that's why I selected that one. In this case, I still wanted to deal with China. I wanted to deal with it closer to home. And I had to look at the major routes. Did I really want to do something on, something in the waterways right between Taiwan and China or something a little off the beaten track? And that's why I chose the Philippines because it has so many islands, so many opportunities, such a rich history. Such a history with domestic terrorism, from international terrorism, from switching back and forth on who they ally with, and to show the criticality of that nation in terms of geopolitics. So that's why I chose this one. And you're right. The other books that like I'm working on run right now and the others will also have a very heavy maritime component. And it's, you know, when I write the novels, part of it is I want to entertain. Like when I go, you know, in the summer to vacation or go on a plane or go on a ship, I want to read a book to be entertained. But you can use those novels to educate and inform in a broader way and to get people to think, okay, well, yeah, this is fiction. However, why why is this area so important? Why are large-scale exercises so important? Why is the decision-making or the personnel who are involved in some of these operations so critical? What if you have the wrong person in charge? And what if you have the right person in charge? So especially with the Aiden effect, I really wanted to study two things beyond the geopolitics. I wanted to study how individuals who are different behave to the same issues or challenges. So I came up with these three characters, Stark, Golzari, and Sumner. So Stark is the guy who believes an injustice over the law. Think of it in terms of what I wrote on the very first page of the Aiden Effect was a quote by Martin Luther King Jr. in Letter from a Birmingham Jail, and that is, everything Hitler did was legal, everything the Hungarian resistance did was illegal. In this case, Connor Stark is the Hungarian resistance in many cases. The second character represents law and order. That's Golzari, the diplomatic security service agent. And the third one, Ambassador Sumner, who is the diplomat who believes in soft power, humanitarian operations to support allies and partners. But what you start to see through this series is how each of them changes in each of the books and almost becomes opposite of what they originally were envisioned as.
You know, you're going through some of the recurring characters there, and when you look at, you know, those are the primary characters. You also have some secondary characters that show up again. But when you look at Connor Stark's company, Highland Maritime Defense, in a lot of ways, it's a land of misfit toys. In the fact that, and also some of the related characters as well, that these are not people that if you lined up all their fit reps or their official records would be seen as success. But, and you're a historian by training, so you know this better than I do, but it's usually those types of misfit toys in history that either are able to do things or to see things in a certain way that really can create an impact. When you look at those characters you outlined, were there some actual individuals from history that people can see echoes of or flavors of in your characters?
Not necessarily in history all the time, but some of them are based not on real characters, but on real events that I saw. And yeah, there are some misfit toys. There are guys like Jay Warren, the crazy engineer from the Upper Peninsula, who is he's the Q of Highland Maritime Defense, who's always coming up with these ideas, but had been kicked out of as being a civilian in the Navy because you know, he was doing catnip. But there are other characters who were essentially either drummed out of the Navy or left the Navy who were really qualified. I think of the junior officer, Bobby Fisk, that we see as an ensign on a newbie ensign on the USS Bennington. And we see Jamie Johnson, Stark's cousin, and she is Naval Academy grad, commands a Navy destroyer. But they leave because of a toxic leadership. And in the character of Admiral Rosberg, we see him first as the unnamed commanding officer of USS Bennington in Aiden Effect. We see him as an admiral, a rear admiral in Siren Song. And we see him again, yes, in Philippine Pact. He initially was based sort of on a one commanding officer I had twice, but not in a bad way. They're one of the finest naval officers and finest individuals I've ever known. A guy by the name of Daryl Hancock, retired as a captain. And basically, I took all the good qualities of Daryl Hancock and I simply inverted them and created the character of Admiral Rosberg. And then later I realized that Admiral Rosberg was getting to be very similar to an actual CO I had in the Navy Reserve. So he's sort of a conglomeration of all of these characteristics. So some are named from history. I mean, Connor Stark, people ask me sometimes, well, you know, it's not very original. I mean, you've got Tony Stark from Marvel Comics, and you've got all these things. I said, yeah, but this was in 1988 that I first envisioned having doing a novel. And at that time, I was writing my senior thesis on General John Stark of the American Revolution. I was in college up in New Hampshire. And so I said, you know what? I'm going to have, when I write a novel, it's going to be the descendant of General John Stark. And on the other side, we see a Russian mercenary, and we see a lot about Russian mercenaries today in Ukraine. And there's a Russian mercenary in this novel that we see briefly in Siren Song, and now he's taken a more prominent role. His last name is Makarov. And I don't think I actually say this in the book, but I envisioned him sort of as an alternate to Stark, where he's now the descendant of Admiral Stepan Makarov of the Russo-Japanese War. So I really try to mix in history, but a lot of what I observe in characters. And just a final thought on that, the three characters, Stark, Golzari, and Sumner, this triad, especially in the first book and now in the second book, I was very heavily influenced by a particular writer in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s before he passed, and wanted to reflect and honor that as well. And then the final, there's a very brief introduction of the Filipino president. And as I was writing it, all I could imagine and envision was the president from The Expanse. So every time I wrote one of her few lines, I had her in mind and what that would sound like.
Well, I would like to clarify that I was, even though I was in the reserves, I was never your commanding officer. Admiral Rosberg is not I don't reflect any aspect of him, but I must admit that there have been quite a few COs in my career that reminded me very much of him. And I think one of the things you point out with him is that he's where he is because he's the benefit of a political system, and mm-hmm. and it, you know, do you, as you write these things, is that another one of those things, the points you're making, that there's a danger in the politicization of our senior leadership in the military?
So I want to be really careful. Again, the views I express my own and not those of the United States Navy or Naval Academy. That being said, prior to working at the Naval Academy, I did work for two U.S. senators, and I did see a lot of interesting political maneuverings and how people would answer or how people would prepare testimony and a lot of other considerations. So, yeah, that's, again, you're spot on with that would something happen like this? Potentially. I mean, I'm just finishing a book about Admiral Rickover. I've been working on this for a while. And, you know, Rickover was passed over for captain. He was passed over for rear admiral. And it wasn't until Congressman Sid Yates of Chicago and a number of other members of Congress really pushed the effort. That's why he became an admiral. That's why he got his second star, why he got his third star, why he got his fourth star. There were a lot of politics with Rickover's rise through the flag ranks. I'm not saying that's bad in that case. I mean, look what the result was. We had the father of the nuclear Navy. But these things do happen. And I don't think we should ignore it, ignore realities.
You mentioned the fact, and most of the listeners of Midrats know, I mean, you've taught at the Naval Academy for a while, and you're a historian by training, and you've written both fiction and nonfiction books. And as you outlined earlier, when you're talking through, you know, how you kind of built the bones of the plot line of the book, that requires imagination, looking at human interactions, you know, like a couple of friends of mine's kids going through the academy, and I when I see them, I say, "Hey, you need to sign up for Dr. Berube's class." But they're all in STEM majors, and the Naval Academy, it does specialize a lot in producing STEM majors. But there's mm-hmm. something about not so much history, but the creative writing process, especially in a venue such as yours that is in the national security segment of the book writing area, that you have to take facts and reality. Physics has to apply, unlike science fiction where you can't have these great, we're just going to go warp factor 10 so we can go real fast. In books such as yours, water is wet, displacement matters, electrons are electrons that obey the laws of physics. People are people, and you have certain personality types that throughout history show up. But it requires the writer to think, to be imaginative. And when you look at a lot of the challenges that we've had in the national security arena, people say it all the time, we never expected that. It was a failure of imagination. Nobody briefed this as a possible course of action. So in the background, there's a hint that one of the things the imperial we don't do too well is to have an imagination and to think. And when you look at your students that are in your class, as we have all these physics and chemistry and engineering requirements that we have that we think is what we need to, get our minds around to be leaders in the Navy. As a writer and somebody who's had to force themselves to go through the fiction writing process and that intellectual effort, do you see a window where creative writing classes are, short story, there's quite a few contests out there for short story writers. Is that a process you see that can activate certain parts of the brain that in a 19, 20, 21-year-old shipman might be good to have exercise for when they're 28, 38, or 48?
Absolutely. In fact, the first thing that I thought of was some of the incredible English professors we have, especially the poetry professors, who really do creative projects with their midshipmen. The same as with a former professor now that I worked with on recreating a Roman Carthaginian naval battle, the Battle of Drepana, where we wanted to teach midshipmen about galley warfare. And instead of reading and writing about it, we got 30 kayaks of different colors from the phys ed department and held the battle on the Severn River right off the Naval Academy. But prior to that, the professor had them do orations, Roman orations, to figure out who was going to be the admiral of the Carthaginian fleet and the Roman fleet. And the best orators then were selected by their people. And it was to show the importance that absolutely we need STEM majors. We need those math and science people and the engineers, but we also need people who can articulate where we need to go, why we need to go somewhere, how we need to get there, who can sort of bridge that gap. So absolutely, and we do have a lot of English and poli-sci majors. In fact, I think every helo pilot on my ship was a poli-sci major, if I'm not mistaken. I'm pretty sure. Writing is so integral to what they're going to be doing in their careers. I just don't think they understand it yet. So that's why I try to show them a fit rep. Like you have this amount of space to write a good fit rep. How do you do it? What words do you use? I think a bigger challenge, quite frankly, is reading. We've now got a generation, and this is not on the academy students. I think this could be of anybody. You've got a generation of TikTok folks who have short attention spans, who can't sit down for 20 or 30 minutes to read 10 or 20 pages of a book. And that can be problematic. It's great to be able to have ideas, but where do you get the ideas from if you're not learning from the past? And I think General Mattis was a perfect example of that. He says, look, you're not always going to be in a war, so you better read about war to see, at least to get a sense of what it's like. Absolutely. I mean, I think the broad range of courses that they take at the academy is absolutely fantastic. But they just need to read more. And I found that that's been far more difficult as I've seen them progress in the past 18 years. 18 years ago, they might have read a little bit more than they do now. But a lot of Americans don't read books anymore. I think it's the last figure I saw was 50% haven't read a book in a long time. And that's a problem.
That is a problem because, well, you have to have the background to understand what's going on. And if they're not reading about it, then they're just getting their, I don't know where they're getting their information. One of the things I really like about your books, and I think you've done this to give yourself some flexibility, but you and I have long talked about private maritime companies, private military agencies, whatever. And of course, we never talked about the Russian folks, but the freedom you've given Connor Stark in this is he started his own PMC, and he's able to do things like become a privateer, gets a letter of marque from the from the Sri Lankan government. Was your thinking just so that he could free him up, and it gives him an excuse to have use the Sea Hunter ship and all that? Is that where you went with this?
Yeah, I wanted to see this sort of like the A-team goes to sea. Initially, it was only something that was envisioned in the background for the first book. And I should say, Aid and Effect was not the first book. It was the first book that was published. But 25 years ago, I actually wrote a Connor Stark novel that takes place in Canada and Washington, D.C. That's actually the prequel, and I'm going to be rewriting that as one of the follow-ons as a prequel. But definitely Sri Lanka, and in this case where they're fighting with the private security company is fighting with the Filipino Navy partners that they have against the bad guys. It absolutely gives me a lot of flexibility. In fact, several years ago, I guess it was like 7 or 8 years ago, there was a producer, screenwriter who was really interested in pitching this as a series as well as a separate Damian Golzari TV series. And, worked with him for about a year along with another screenwriter, and they pitched it to Hollywood, and it came down to two series. And at that time they said, you know what, it would just cost too much to turn this into a series as much as we like it. So, you know, it's one of those almost. But again, it showed, because I had to do a treatment of 10 episodes just to show the viability of a series. And so I came up with, you know, two or three paragraph storylines for 10 episodes. And in each case, there is flexibility, and there's always something going on around the world. Pick up the newspaper, pick up The Economist, and there's something going on the high seas. I mean, there was just an incident where the 44th task escort group of the Chinese Navy just got deployed, I think, two or three weeks ago. And, you know, they had a Chinese trawler in the middle of the Indian Ocean, 39 people, and the Indian government is trying to work on rescues. So you can really develop something out of that. But I also think that the fact that we've got now 44 Chinese task forces that have gone to the Horn of Africa, who have built up all this experience, is part of what I talk about in Evolve in the books.
I think we've talked about this before on a separate topic. If not, I'll surprise you with it now. But we're roughly the same age. So one of the things as I was reading the Philippine Pact that came to mind was, Claude sees it too. And I know for a fiction writer, networks and relationships, they help move things along. But the older I get, and it's really clicked for me in my mid-30s, is the importance of personal networks. You know, like REM said, the perfect circle of acquaintances and friends. And one thing that keeps the action moving on a really global scale, which in today's communication environment, it's quite easy. I've seen it with my youngest daughter, who will be up on a Zoom call with friends that she's made in Burma or Myanmar, depending on who you are, Austria, Australia, England, Germany, herself up in Canada, and they're all talking in real time. But your characters have developed a network that can lead them from backwater bars all the way up to into the White House. And you spent a lot of time in D.C. I know you've seen similar networks. If you ever had an opportunity to talk with some of your midshipmen who might be interested in the work you do, to talk about not just the art and effort of being a writer, but how networks such as this, they do exist in a personal and professional environment, so it's not just a plot device.
Yeah, and by the way, I have to apologize. My dog is just going crazy, and it's in the way the house is. You're going to hear him, and I apologize to your listeners. I actually do tell my students how important it is to network, and I think back on my own career, and first coming to Washington D.C. in 1991, and some of the people that I started off with are now in very senior positions, especially in the Biden administration. Because this was I was working for a Democratic senator at the time, but you spend enough decades in a particular region, or overseas. I mean, I can think of it was kind of funny that I think it was I met him my second for a senator, and I was flown off my ship to the Milius, and the Milius pulled in, got me to Djibouti, and then I had to take a C-130 from Djibouti to Bahrain. Well, by the time I arrive in Bahrain, it's about midnight, and my mind is mush. I had to be flown home on an emergency leave. My mother had just passed, and I'm coming off the C-130, and who do I see but this guy Shubab Kheri? And I was just like, Shubab, what are you doing here in Bahrain? He goes, well, I was just about to go home for the night, and I was looking at the names of people who were coming through. I saw your name, and I wanted to come by, say hi, and see if you need anything. And, if you wrote that in a novel, it would be seen as disingenuous or unrealistic. But these things happen all the time. I'm sure you guys saw this as well, that somebody you meet in D.C. or back home, you run into again. And, yeah, I do want that reflected in the novels. I think it is. And networks are so important to Connor Stark. The friendships he's developed, and sometimes even some of the enemies with regard to the nefarious Mr. Hu, who's in charge of a Chinese company, that will follow you your whole life. And you're absolutely right. Networks are incredibly important. And I also tell my mids this, is that, whatever they do at the academy will follow them positively or negatively throughout their careers, because people will always remember that. It may not be the same if you're an ROTC or if you were a DIRCOM reservist like me, but when you spend 4 years in a very tight environment, those people are going to know you, and do something bad, they're going to remember it twice as much.
Well, that's an interesting problem. And one of the things that we've kind of hit on this before, but you get a screamer for a CO or a CO who's bad for some reason, and you get these a negative fitness report, and the way the Navy works, as you're well aware, that will haunt you for a long time, mm-hmm. and may even permanently haunt you. And yet the Connor Stark offers up an alternative to the two people who got trashed by the admiral. Is there a way? Just this is kind of a side question, but is there a way around a system that tars people so early, potentially so early in their careers, not because they did a bad job, but just because they had a bad boss?
Yeah, and I've seen this. I've known officers who have left. I mean, I knew one former student of mine who. Just incredible. She was one of the best I've ever taught. And I couldn't believe when she left, having just made lieutenant commander, I was just kind of gobsmacked. And I talked to her about it, and she said, I've had some great assignments, but this last one on the ship with this CO was just so bad that I just said, forget about it. I'm not going to the reserves. I'm not doing anything. Could these people come back? I would love to see some sort of program, but it's really tough once you have that tarnished relationship with a larger organization to bring them back into that same organization, because you never know. That commander or who was a captain at the time, sorry, commander at the time, might now be an admiral. And, you know, you're telling that young officer, yeah, we want you back, but we've also promoted somebody who's, you know, a screamer or whatever. I've told people that I've known, I said, look, if the active duty community isn't for you, then at least stick it out in the reserves. And what you can do, there are opportunities to go back when you want under certain conditions, either at sea or overseas. And it's a great opportunity, and you can still bring your skill set. But more and more, I'm seeing just a lot of people leave. There's a large percentage of people who leave after their first tour or so. And it's I feel bad because I see all the potential we are losing in our Navy from these incredible, incredible junior officers that I've known since they were plebes, and on whom I've had high hopes. A lot of them I selected for when I was on active duty at the Academy. You know, some of them I selected for the Intel program, had incredibly high hopes, and now they're out because it for whatever reasons. And that's one of the things that bothers me with regard to great power competition is that, and I wanted that reflected, especially in this large-scale exercise you see in the Philippine PAC, how many of those officers in that briefing room after seeing Admiral Rosberg do what he does, how many of them are going to stay in? And I do want people to think about that when they read the book. That's not only there, it's not some sort of gratuitous scene. It's to make people think about what are the consequences of those particular actions on our general capability as a Navy if we're losing really qualified people like some of the junior officers you see in that briefing room.
Yeah, a phrase I've used talking to a few people is incentives and disincentives that people have and motivators and demotivators. And it's not an insignificant problem like you've seen, and I continue to see. I just had two individuals, classic cases, that I've seen in the last year who, no organization is perfect, but you spend, a dozen to 15 years in the Navy, and inexplicitly you're put on an off-ramp with no recovery, it can really impact people and how they not just view the Navy, but what's really tragic, especially if it's a byproduct of a toxic personality, is how they view themselves. And, it sounds cynical, but I think it's actually healthy for people's mental health is, never forget that you may love the Navy, but the Navy probably doesn't love you all that much. It can really, one of the individuals I just talked with again a few months ago really took it hard. But there are options and ways that people can turn the corner. I like what you said about the Naval Reserve. I've seen quite a few people who, for whatever reason, they hit a hole or fell into a swamp on active duty, but they took their skills and their background into the reserves. And, in fact, one of the individuals actually retired as a flag officer in the reserves. I remember him as a lieutenant. He had a list of pros and cons of staying in the Navy or getting out of the Navy. And he had nothing on staying in the Navy, but he wound up working out just fine for him in the reserves. Great guy. I never busted him in public once he made flag officer, but we all have stories. But speaking of stories, as a guy who on my Twitter profile, if people ever go there, I identify as my home as being Navassa Island, which those who have spent time in the Caribbean know where that is. I'm also a big fan of Jan Mayen. But in your novel, Claude, you seem to have a similar predilection that I have. There's a soft spot in your heart for isolated and weird islands. For instance, in the Aiding Effect, we had Socotra. And here we have Balabac Island. As a writer, is there, besides the fact it's just fun to talk about something nobody else talks about, is there something about these relatively unknown geographical areas that happen to be in some of the most well-known and important parts of the world, they kind of draws you to help wrap a story around.
Sure, I think it's the mystery. You know, I've been very fortunate to go to a lot of places around the world, but there are a lot of places I haven't been. I did actually sail past Socotra Island in 2005, and it's this appeal to mystery. I want to unravel the mystery of a place, and I want to learn about it. And in the case of Socotra Island, I was going back through really ancient texts and some of the first mentions, and seeing that one of the apostles may have gone through Socotra Island. But more importantly, it's because they really lend the opportunity for me to use the private security company ships in a way that I couldn't if this was a story, you know, based in Mongolia. There's just the reality of the ocean. But there are a lot of islands. I have to really pick the islands that are near these either strategic choke points or these major trade routes that could well be disrupted if something happens there. And it gives me a chance to learn about it. I mean, Socotra Island is still one of those places I would love to visit if ever the opportunity came about, because it's known as the Galapagos of the Indian Ocean. It has some of the most unique flora and fauna in the world. But even Balabac Island, as I started researching it and looking at the options of the Philippine Islands I was going to use, there were unique things to that as well. So I'm very much drawn to these islands. There was one case where I almost used an island that I went to and flew over off the west coast of Sumatra, Simalu Island, which was very close to the epicenter of the 2004 tsunami. We were flying over in SH-60 Bravo. And that really appealed to me. And I figure if I'm going to write about something, I might as well write about something that appeals to me, that I want to unravel the mystery and I want to take the time to research and tell and incorporate into the storyline. Over.
Eagle One, you there?
Yes, but I pushed the wrong button. So when you push mute and then talk, it does nothing happens.
It's all right. A lot of people push mute when I start talking.
My dog was barking. Okay, let's see. A couple of years ago, I was reading some articles on people who were suggesting that one way to help handle China is to go the privateering route again. And I started that struck me that when I was reading your books, that somebody's been thinking Connor Stark style. And what do you think? Is Mr. Stark going to get involved in privateering activity other than the letter of marque that he had from Sri Lanka? Is this going to be a thing of the future?
I think doing a letter of marque for Sri Lanka in the case of the second book is a different case, because it's an relatively isolated region, and one in which you're not going to have the entire Chinese government coming down on you. I mean, I imagine that if there were privateers being used against China, China would deal with them in the same way they deal with the Uyghurs. There would be a mass approach to it and, you know, kind of a take no prisoners. I don't know how effective privateers would be. We're talking a very different era when you're looking at letters of marque of the age of sail. They could be effective because the ships that the merchants had were more or less, and I know there are differences, I teach naval history, but more or less they are very similar. The weapons used aboard a privateer would be very similar to those you might find on a small warship, a sloop, or a schooner. In today's case, what is a privateer going to use? Are they going to use a slow freighter? Probably not. Those are just a target. Are they going to use a super high-speed, super Bezos-level cruise ship or a personal yacht where you wouldn't be able to mount very many weapons or have access to them, quite frankly? So I don't think that there's a realistic use of that unless you're talking about trying to somehow take over or sink or do whatever to Chinese merchant ships. And again, I just don't see that as a realistic endeavor to the level that you would need. You would, given the size of the Chinese merchant fleet, I don't think you would even put a dent in that. And then you'd have to worry about logistics processes. You know, in the age of sail, you had sails. All you had to really worry about was having enough beer aboard, 2 gallons a day roughly for each sailor, and you could sail. You can't simply take a modern privateer, sail it 5,000 miles, and then expect to find fuel somewhere, unless you were working with a particular government. So from a practical standpoint, I just don't see how that might be employed. That being said, one of the first articles I wrote on this issue was called Black Waters for the Blue Waters, The Promise of Private Naval Companies. I wrote it for Orbis in 2006 or 2007. But I didn't say take these new 21st century privateers and attack a nation's merchant fleet or anything. What I envisioned was taking these private security companies and doing low-end operations, whether it's drug interdiction in the Caribbean or at that time protecting, doing convoy duty of ships in the Gulf of Aden, in order to free up our assets, our destroyers and our cruisers, to redeploy where they are truly needed in great power competition. There is no reason, for example, when Somali piracy was really major, that you had a small sailboat that Somali pirates had taken with two Americans, two Canadians, the SV Quest. You had two destroyers, a cruiser, and an aircraft carrier surrounding that sailboat. Okay, this is a bit much. I think if you had had the model of private security ships for the Gulf of Aden, I think you might have been more effective globally by shifting over your big assets elsewhere.
I guess this might be considered a spoiler. So spoiler alert, it is revealed kind of early on what the common thread is here. So if people don't want any quasi plot reveals early on, go ahead and go walk the dog for the next couple, 3 minutes. But in researching a fiction novel, sometimes you can pick some areas you need to research that can really take you some dark places. Mm-hmm. And without showing too much leg here, one of the common threads has to do with international human trafficking, really modern day slavery. How deep did you dig into that topic? And were there some surprises, plus or minus, that you discovered in the course of research in that area?
Yeah, so there were a couple of things that I really tried to do deep dives on. The first one was actually the drones that are used in here are based on an actual company's drones, DPI, out of Philadelphia, and I actually call them by name in the book, and I got permission from the CEO of the company, and I'll be going up here to Philadelphia in the next couple of weeks to talk with them again and do a little video. But yeah, on human trafficking, you know what, I started off with a baseline of the GMT, the general military training that we all get on it. And then I just started going through, you know, the figurative Rolodex that I've had over the years and talked to law enforcement officials. I talked to some folks overseas, and, you know, you kind of pull the thread that way. It's like, okay, if I'm talking to person A here that I knew in college, say, okay, I need to understand this. What do you see here in the big cities in the United States? So do you ever work with people outside of the country? What kind of organization would I need to talk to? So yeah, I did talk to people who dealt with human trafficking both domestically and internationally to try to get a better understanding of that. And I try to do that, you know, in all the books. I really try to do the research. In the first book, it was like I wanted to understand what would it be like to have dinner with Mutahar, the merchant / multi-gazillionaire that it turns out. What kind of food? What does food smell like? What does it taste like? What are the ingredients to these things? Just to lend some reality to it. In some cases, it's light reality, and in cases of the human trafficking thread that I have in this particular book, it's the dark realities.
Yeah, I want to go back a little bit to the private military companies or the private naval companies in the case of Stark, because what we saw in the with the Somali pirates was the we were way overkill as far as warships go, but what seemed to have the most effect was when we started putting private security guards on the merchant ships and using arsenal ships to, you know, so the countries that were worried about having too many weapons ashore didn't react to that. But, I mean, it was kind of, it's not quite the same as having private ships fighting the pirates, but, mm-hmm. but the, you know, it is the functional equivalent, I would think. Is that off base? And I know that I think in one of the books you kind of discussed those armed security guards on the merchant ships.
Yeah, I think that was my second or third nonfiction book on, it was on private security at sea in the 21st century. But yeah, I think that still stands. Any ship that had private secure armed guards aboard was never taken by Somali pirates. And now Somali piracy is a thing of the past, more or less. But during that time, I think that's really telling. And at the beginning of this whole thing, of the whole Somali piracy trend, I remember being at a maritime security conference, and I was talking about about this concept of black waters of blue waters. And there was a guy at the back of the room in D.C., and he got up and starts yelling at me. He says, "You don't know what you're talking about. There will never be armed guards on any of our ships, blah-de-blah-de-blah." I was like, okay, I appreciate it. Thanks. I hope not. And about a year later, his company, pretty large company, I learned was using armed guards aboard because they had to. And so I've always learned, you know, never say never. That's a really dangerous word when you're talking about security.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things to hear people say, especially if they say it with a lot of emotion. You know, that will never. That's like, we have to. Those two words usually is followed by my favorite word in the English language, why, which is very triggering to people who aren't used to having people ask that question. Now, we've seen from the Aiden effect on that the center of the tactical action, though the webs go globally, keeps moving further east. And I don't know if you'd be comfortable revealing what's knocking around your head here, but if you look east of the Philippines, are there a few places that, if it doesn't result in a Connor Stark novel, but
yeah,
something that you think people should be looking at, because I know your mind is always bouncing around looking under rocks for the unseen.
So like Christopher Columbus's gold, if you go further and further west, eventually you'll find yourself in the east and right back to where you came from. And that's where this is roughly going. You're going to be going so far east, so Gulf of Aden, Indian Ocean, Sri Lanka, South China Sea. The next one is going to be coming around the globe, and it's going to start hitting closer to home.
Ooh.
So,
China's
very effective. You know, China's just effective.
They are.
Yeah. You mentioned the nonfiction maritime private security book, to which, by the way, in interest of full disclosure, I contributed a chapter. How about the other books? The book on Captain Stewart, has that reflected in your fiction writing?
Some. So Siren Song. In fact, Captain Charles Stewart commanded a ship called Siren during the Tripoli War. That was his second command when he was a lieutenant along in Preble's squadron. And that's why toward the end of Siren Song, for those who haven't read Siren Song, I won't expose a surprise, but there is an Age of Sail incident. And I tried to do that. I did that at the end of Aiden Effect, did that at the end of Siren Song, where Stark really uses history to solve a tactical issue. So in that way, I can use some of the stuff that I've researched for my naval history class or for my books and actually employ it in a way that I would hope my students do In fact, the past couple of years, I'm not going to do this next year, but I had students for their final exam say that they were the CNO, I'm the president, and they have to, their final exam is to write a formal memo to me that we are going into ethnic clashistan, it is going to be a naval conflict, and what 10 pieces of advice would you give me in conducting this war? And with each of those, give me three examples in naval history that they've studied that support those recommendations. So I'm trying to get them thinking, and that's why I try to do that in the books, is bringing a little bit of naval history into the novels as well. And hopefully it'll inspire people to look at it more. I mean, look at, you know, you go down the Wikipedia rabbit hole, but before there was Wikipedia, you know, when the three of us were kids, you know, and I'd go to the library to pick up a book, and I'd see a sentence in one book, I'm like, I want to know more about that. So I'd go pick up another book and figure out what that meant. And those are some of the rabbit holes that I'd like to see people go through in not just being entertained again, but in learning about something from these books that they might not otherwise.
One thing I hope that the reader does, it's a predilection of mine. I love globes. I love Google Earth. I like making little measurements and stuff. But when you look at the geometry in the Philippines, and again, without doing another plot spoiler, as I watched a couple of the threads develop, especially in the second half of the book, it reminded me in that 5,000-year history that China has as a reference point. Our history is but a subchapter compared to their larger book, that in their near abroad, not just ashore, but also in sea, it one time reached all the way out to Okinawa, included Korea, a lot of the islands in the South China Sea and those peripheral areas. They had, lack of a better phrase, not allies, but subservient kingdoms to them, and they see themselves as that is their rightful place in their near abroad, not unlike what we used to think about in the Caribbean, in Central and South America, and especially a portion where you look at what the Chinese could move forward in the Western Pacific at emergency compared to what the U.S. Navy can. With a big asterisk there, be careful how many allies you're leaning on. But is that something you would hope that the reader, when looking at this, would pause for a moment and maybe look at a map and dig into the little history a bit about not just how the neighbors look at China, but perhaps more critically with her strength, how China views the proper place for those lesser nations it finds to its south and its east.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And again, without spoiling the second half of the book and what happens, I think we see that play out and how China can try to exert its influence by dividing allies and gaining partners, however small. Even a small island can be a very powerful ally. And I think back in, I think it was 2006, I visited six Caribbean islands. And what was strange, I think it was all of them, had those Chinese arches and big construction of cricket stadiums, and Chinese were everywhere. And, you know, this is 17 years ago. And I asked one of the guides, and I said, well, what's going on here? They said, well, the Chinese are our friends. They're building these cricket stadiums for the international cricket, whatever it was in 2007. And so when I came back to the academy, I talked to one of our experts on China, and I slapped down the names of those six islands I went to. And without giving him any context, I said, what can you tell me about these in China? And he says, huh. That's interesting. Four of these just in the past couple of years have switched their recognition at the UN from Taiwan to mainland China. So we see this soft power emerge, and now I don't think Taiwan has more than 10 countries that recognize it in the United Nations. So when you're talking about China playing the long game, and Salamander, you've had this the long game series on your blog, That's exactly what they're doing. And again, that's in our own backyard. Caribbean is I won't say it's our South China Sea, but we've been down there a while, and we've got a naval base, you know, right smack dab in the middle of the Caribbean. And I think that will play out for some very interesting events in the coming decades.
Well, I hope it's not that interesting. I would like it to, but I think I'm hoping against the odds there. Well, you mentioned you're working on a Rickover book. We've taken up your hour, but we could of course talk for hours and hours and hours as we have in the past. Tell us a little bit about the Rickover book. Tell us what your expectation is for it being published, and do you find him to be a fascinating figure? Was he a lot of people have up and down opinions about him. Did great things, mm-hmm. not necessarily the nicest person on the planet. But others have a different view.
Yeah. So first of all, I do have an agent, and I've got to give him a rewrite for something to add something in here, and he's going to be taking care of the pitches with the big publishers. But this goes back a few years ago when I started meeting with Mrs. Rickover, his second wife, Eleanor. She passed away, I guess it was a year and a half ago now. But before she passed, she and her co-executors bequeathed more than 100 boxes of his personal papers to the Naval Academy Museum. And so I've been working with Special Collections and Archives and an initial cataloging of them. But these go back to 1929. These include daily love letters to his first wife, or then his girlfriend who became his wife, in the 1930s that are incredibly detailed and show such a different aspect of Rickover. I could not believe this was Rickover, and I don't think anybody else will. But it goes throughout his career. I'm going to include a few congressional hearing excerpts. Those are publicly available. But he gave hundreds of speeches that he wrote on his own on a variety of topics. He has letters with presidents, CNOs. He did memoranda for the record just for his personal files. Every time he met with another admiral, a senator, a president, he wrote up a page or two on this is what we discussed. That is incredible primary sources. And then also the transcripts of telephone conversations he had with journalists, with CNOs, with the whole gamut of people that we talked about. And it is more than 100 archive boxes. I think it's closer to about 250. It was 100 regular boxes, but in archive terms, it's closer to 250. So it's taken a long time to go through those. But I really think people are going to get a very different perspective on parts of Rickover's life. I think it will also validate a lot of the things that we've all come to know and learn about Rickover in terms of being acerbic and et cetera. But he was a very complex individual, and I think these documents, this primary research, will show that. And I'm going to be doing it in a very different way than a traditional biography. So I'm pretty much, I've got maybe 3 or 4 more weeks of research to go through the last sources, and then it's right to the drawing board and trying to get this out.
Well, at least we have one more reason to invite you on to Midrats again. And Claude, again, thank you very much for an hour to come on. Best of luck. And again, for the listeners, the book is The Philippine Pact. It's the third in the Connor Stark series. And I saw via my Amazon tracker that some of y'all have decided to go back to the very beginning and to start with the first book. And that's, but you can pick it up solo. You don't have to start at the beginning. And hope you have a great summer, Claude, and look forward to the next opportunity.
Thank you very much to both of you. I really appreciate it. Have a good day.
Take care, Claude.
And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. And until next time, hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're
Oh!